Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Better Than Life, the podcast where comedians talk Red Dwarf episode by episode. I'm John, a lapsed fan, returning to the show for the first time in decades.
And I'm Fergus, a resolutely unlapsed fan. Today we're going to be talking about Series 3, Episode 5, Time Slides, with Jono. Hit that theme!
It's a show about a man who's lost 3 million years in space. His company and evolved cat and a hologram he hates. Plus a fussy robot. It's Better Than Life.
Our guest this week is a comedian, composer, and actor. He's a writer on brilliant shows like Wedding Season and Siblings, and he's one third of sketch powerhouse Sheeps. It's Duran Jono Johnson. Thanks so much for being on the show, Jono.
Hi.
This Red Dwarf thing, you a fan or no?
Yes, I have a complicated relationship to it. I have reservations as I get older and older, but fundamentally, yes.
Reservations about the show as it has progressed, or reservations about the episodes you loved when you were younger? Are they changing for you and your perception of them?
My answer to those three questions is different depending on what series we're talking about. Mm. I've always been a fan of 1 to 6. Get older, I gravitate more and more to 1 and 2.
So when did you get into it? Where were you when you first witnessed?
I was staying over at my friend's house in Birmingham. I'm from Yorkshire, but we met on holiday. And I went to stay at his house. Before I watched any episode of Red Dwarf, do you remember there was a night, I think it was on BBC Two, and it was like Red Dwarf night. They broadcast a load of Smeg ups. I think they broadcast the Smeg outs as well. Then they did Can't Smeg, Won't Smeg, which was them doing Can't Cook, Won't Cook. And then they also did, I think, something like Universe Challenge, which was University Challenge, but them doing it. There was a lot of interviews with them, and they were showing clips. And so I was watching a night that was honouring this show that I'd never seen before.
They must have been at the absolute peak of their success at that point.
They'd done 6, and I think 7 was on the way. I think it was celebrating the fact that it was coming back, that actually not that big of a gap between 6 and 7. I think of it as huge, but it's...
at the time, yeah.
Yeah, I felt like, oh, I want to know what this thing is. I was really excited by it. So I got really into that, and then my mum bought me a VHS of... I would have been probably 8 or 9 years old. She bought me a VHS of the first 3 episodes of Series 1. And I was like, oh, for Christmas, can I get the next one? And she bought me a VHS of the first 3 episodes of Series 2. Yeah. And then I was like, oh, for Christmas, can I get the next one? And she got me the VHS of the first 3 episodes of Series 3. So for many, many years, which is partly why Time Slides, the episode we're going to talk about later, is exciting to me, is because it's from the back half of Series 3.
Mm, yeah, it's fresh still. Did it still make sense for you, like the chronology of it? It was just like, oh, it's 5 3 episode series, I guess.
For sure. I mean, it doesn't make sense if you watch them in order.
So I'm just trying to think. Series 1, Episode 3 is Balance of Power, right? So did you come then to Series 2 assuming that Lister had become the superior officer via the chef's exam?
Yeah, that was because I didn't I believe it's Waiting for God next.
Yeah, that's right.
Which opens with Holly joking that Lister lied about becoming the captain. But yeah, so I was surprised. And so when I watched Crichton, the first episode of series two, I did think, why is he not sat in the front? Like,
were you already into comedy by that point? Were you aware of sitcom?
Yes, I loved Chuckle Vision. And it wasn't super long after Chuckle Vision that Red Dwarf came. I mean, that was more or less what I graduated from one to the other.
The Chuckle Brothers having a very similar dynamic to Lister and Rimmer in a lot of ways.
Well, you must come on my Chuckle Vision podcast at some point. we'll repay the favour. But it arrived as Red Dwarf arrived as a sort of package deal of shows that I got into all at the same time. Of, I suppose, Blackadder and Only Fools and Horses would be the other shows that I started watching more or less at the same time as it. But Red Dwarf won the day just because, I still think even as a comedy writer now as my job, I still think it wasn't a huge comedy influence on me. I feel like I enjoy it far more as a sci-fi than I do as a comedy.
When you say that the comedy is ground down a little bit for you, because we can separate out the comedy in the show, right? There's jokes, there's one-liners, there's situational stuff, but I think the writing for the characters is so rich still.
The characters are amazing. I really, really do think, particularly, Rimmer, I do think, is about as good a comedy character as there's been in anything. I mean, I think that the fundamental funniest thing to me about Rimmer is that he's a guy, and everybody can identify with him on some level. He's somebody who feels like things ought to have gone better for him. He didn't get all the best opportunities in life. And yet, in every parallel universe that we see, he's the biggest hero in the world, like somebody who had exactly the same opportunities. And even in this universe, he has three brothers who are all admirals. So we know that he's wrong. It's fundamentally nonsense. But then in the later series, they have the reveal that he's half-brothers with them. Just slightly changes it, just enough to be like, I don't know whether that, I think that's watered down the joke a little bit.
It takes quite a stance on nature versus nurture there, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does, because it suggests, oh, maybe the dad was treating him differently because of his personal resentments, and maybe he was like starting from a different point. You know, it's, I don't know.
But I see what you mean, though. It undermines the character, because we know Rimmer is at his best when it is 100% his fault that he's so miserable, right? And so alone.
Well, that's why the one of my, easily in my top five episodes, Me Too, from the end of series one, I still have in my diary, and always have had, on my calendar, Gazpacho Stoop Day because of that episode, which I always remember. I always watch an episode of it, whatever I'm doing that day, just because it stayed with me so much, the idea that he decides he'll be the best company for himself and hates him immediately. Even he can't stand him. I think it's perfect. But the sci-fi of it stays with me, and the sort of existentialist dread of the situation was just really exciting to me from a young age. Mm.
What is that? Why is it attractive? It shouldn't be, the idea of someone just floating 3 million years out there.
I think it's the ultimate locked in the supermarket fantasy of, like, it's just him and everybody else is technically there, but like Cat's a pet and Rimmer's not actually there, and Crichton and Holly are, you know, but arguably not alive. I'm an only child, and the things that I prized above everything else growing up, not to sound too cool, were utter solitude and books, comics, video games, and just like nobody else being around or talking to me. That was just like, and occasionally I'd look at Red Dwarf and I'd be so excited to be like, oh, I could watch so much stuff, or I could, and then, you know, particularly when the ultimate cop-out of the Better Than Life video game comes in, or the Total Immersion video games from later on in the series as well in six, I just thought, well, that's perfect. Why would you ever want anybody back?
Are we rounding around something quite profound about the fact that, yes, life is objectively better without responsibility, but ultimately it's quite nice to have people around eventually? It is series 3, episode 5, before Lister even starts to go, oh, I'm bored. And it's not stressed. He's just bored. It's ennui, right? They've done everything there is to do.
Despite there being no reason for him to think it is going to work out, it's a smart move that they give him the hope. He's absurdly has the hope he's going to somehow get with Kachansky. And there's that line of, I think it's Rimmer who says this about himself, that some would say that given we're 3 million years in deep space and the human race is, the entire human race is dead, some people might say I'm leaving it a little bit on the late side in terms of settling down and meeting someone. But I like the idea that Lister keeps that hope in his heart. And I suppose when COVID started, for the first 4 months, I was totally alone with no contact with anyone. And I suddenly had this thing that I wanted. And within 2 months, I'd gone mad. I couldn't do it. But as a kid, I didn't think that bit through. I just thought, well, infinite amount of this is perfect. So now when I look at it, I feel differently. But prior to COVID, I would have still said, oh, that's the ultimate fantasy. It's no responsibility tied to myself.
Kids these days have been brought up on stories about it could be you being a wizard or the chosen one or the prophesied one. But no, apparently in the late 80s, early 90s, it was the fantasy was being alone for a bit.
Nice.
You've mentioned that Rimmer is an impeccable comic character. We can all agree on that. Well, how do you feel about Lister? Has he changed for you as you've gotten older?
He's a really decent guy. When I watch it back, I think of all of them, I think the actor who pulls off the very... I think it's a remarkable performance from him. In terms of, he gets a lot of lines that aren't really dialogue. They're like little monologues. A lot of Lister's lines are tough on the page.
He sells it with what, as a kid, I thought was a lack of experience in performance. But what I'm seeing now as an actor is like an innate naturalism. The line John and I talked about a few episodes ago is when he's poorly and he's walking down the corridor and he goes, I don't feel well. Yeah. As an actor, if I saw that line on the page, I would freak out. How am I supposed to say that? Can I not show you that? Like, I've got to say the words, I don't feel well.
He just has total sincerity.
Yeah.
I buy everything he's saying, and I buy that he's coming up with it in the moment, and I think it's the best performance in the show.
Yeah, he's well, again, time slides, he's doing a lot of dramatic heavy lifting, especially in the first half. And then he becomes quite the comic character in the second half. He gets to do a lot, which we are going to get to shortly. Just a couple of little questions. You mentioned probably an arbitrary top five. Is it arbitrary? Me Squared, Marooned? What else would you put up there? What are your favourite apps?
Look, I'm not the coolest guy in the world. I've ranked every episode.
Oh, my days.
In this context, you are. Your cool stakes have gone up as a result of saying that.
Number one is Thanks for the Memory.
Wow, that's your top... Wow, okay.
Just to clarify, Thanks for the Memory is not just my favourite episode of Red Dwarf. Thanks for the Memory is my favourite episode of any television show. None of the criticisms I would level at any other episode of Red Dwarf apply to Thanks for the Memory. The dialogue is perfect. It's my favourite episode of anything, and I think it's a huge part of why I wanted to be a writer, is watching that episode over and over and over again. I'm totally obsessed with Thanks for the Memory. I'm almost mostly a Thanks for the Memory fan and then incidentally a Red Dwarf fan. So like the gap between my first favourite episode and my second favourite episode is enormous. But Thanks for the Memory, I think, is so perfect.
Are we talking comedic genius? Are we talking you're a fan of that kind of puzzle box nature of the episode?
I think both. I think it's one of, if not the funniest episodes. It's got a great... Yeah, I love the puzzle box quality of it. It's a great mystery. The idea of putting a memory in somebody, a memory of yours, a period of your life in somebody else's head, and it changing them that fundamentally is... like so beautiful and terrifying. How you think of the characters before that episode and by the end of that episode is like night and day. They're just instantly deepened so much. I think it's real genius, and I've watched it so many times and I know it like a song. I just love it. Anyway, that's my number one. I promise I won't do a spiel about the next four. Number two, Marooned. Number three, Back to Reality.
Oh,
yes. Back to Reality is phenomenal. Me Too would be Me Squared. And a weird call for top five, but then it would be, the fifth one would be Future Echoes.
Ah.
I think because the first episode is one of those pilots where it works more like a half hour movie, as in you're getting us to what the show's going to be like, but it isn't an episode of the show. I feel like Future Echoes is like, well, this is your first actual episode. And it also establishes some fun stuff in the future, like, to look out for. Every series of Red Dwarf, I think, has one episode that explicitly deals with the question of, are there better ways I might have lived my life? season five has two of those episodes, I think, which are Back to Reality and The Inquisitor. But yeah, that like usually my favourite episode is that one.
Well, let's move into Time Slides shortly.
Well, I would say number six on my list is Time Slides.
Is it really? Oh, that's great news.
I was afraid to ask. That's good. That's really good.
But the contentious question, if you had to recast, how would you cast it?
It's a real struggle. What I'll start with is my Holly, no questions asked, would be Alice Sneddon. Fantastic comedian. Very, 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 very funny from New Zealand. That's my Holly, no questions asked. Well, you can ask questions, obviously. Imagine doing it doing a podcast where you got no questions asked. I meant no questions asked of me, as to myself, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
No questions asked. For Lister and Rimmer, I always thought it would be good to cast my sketch partners, Al Roberts and Liam Williams, my co-best friends who I'm in sketch group Sheeps with. Al is a pretty perfect Rimmer. Al was actually in Red Dwarf. He played Count Ludo in The Promised Land. The name is not mentioned in the episode. I've got to ask him about this. I bet he asked to be named because he's like, his character's clearly not a count. Cat, I'd probably go with, I almost considered saying her for Lister, but Ellie White, who would be a phenomenal Lister, but I also think Kat, I think she'd be a good Kat. I think she'd just do something daft with it.
Yeah, she's pretty fearless. It'd be a different type of Kat, wouldn't it?
You could give Ellie the exact same lines and say, just do that. She is really great. She can do anything, I think. Crichton, I would go Phil Wang, I think.
Oh, nice.
For Crichton. I'm basically going my contemporaries. Cool. All these people are like contemporaries who I know.
No, that's nice. You've done some friends some real nice favours. And actually, Phil particularly is one of those names where you go, oh yeah, how has no one thought of that before?
Absolutely.
They'd be my five.
I'm sorry, I know you said no questions, but if you could play any cameo or guest character in any of the episodes, would any of those take your fancy?
I'd like to be Timothy Spall. I'd like to be the guy that gets them out and explains that they've been doing their life wrong. I think I could do a good Queeg. I think I could have been a good Queeg.
Oh, nice. Really? How are you with calling people sucker?
I might change the line.
It is time for John to give us a little bit of a recap about this lovely episode.
Lister has, of late, lost all his mirth. He's sick of devising ingenious ways to waste time, tiddlywinks, show jumping, Durex volleyball, unicycle polo, pathetic, idiotic, puerile. In the dark room, Crichton makes an eye-popping discovery. His photos are alive? The developing fluid has mutated, of course. Lister is delighted by the novel experience of being beaten up when he crashes Frank Rimmer's wedding photo. The stakes are raised further at a Nazi rally, flipping the bird at Hitler. They've got a time machine. And the rules are clear. They can't go outside the frame of a photograph. They can't, okay, they can't do that. That's the rules. Lister decides to change his past. Inside a photo of Smeg and the Heads gig, he tries to persuade his younger self, Agit, to invent the tension sheet instead of Rimmer's schoolboy contemporary, Thicky Holden. Young Lister dismisses this piece of crypto-fascist bourgeois crap, egged on by Rimmer, who may have convinced even himself that he likes the Om song. But it works. Everyone disappears, except Rimmer and Holly. So Rimmer pays Lister a visit via a video that they presumably immerse in developing fluid because they said that's how this worked. Anyway, Rich Lister is bad, 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 baby, and not in the good way. Stepping into the video of the outside of Lister's mansion, Rimmer appears inside because... Lister doesn't recognise old Iron Balls and is unmoved by Rimmer's iconic You Call This Happiness speech. Rimmer disappears out of the edge of the frame of the video. But wait, attention-popping minute. Rimmer has a new plan. There's a photo of him at boarding school, age 8. Don't think about who took it in the middle of the night while the boys are asleep. Don't. It will mess you up. Thicky Holden overhears Rimmer telling his younger self to invent the tension sheet. And in a not-so-thicky-after-all move, he must beat Bonehead to the patent office because back on the dwarf, the others appear and Rimmer goes nowhere. But wait, something is different. He's alive. He can touch. He can feel. He can fondle. He can accidentally whack 2 crates of explosives, lowering the boom on an episode of pure brilliance. Just don't think about the rules. This episode... I just want to say this before we get into the questions, just to unburden myself for a moment. This episode really hit me unexpectedly. I think last time I saw this, my memory of Time Slides really was, oh, that's the one with Lister's band and crypto fascists and the Om song. Watching it now, at an age when I'm old enough to, you know, rue my life choices and be riddled with regrets, I find the whole thing super poignant, but also really, really hilarious. Like, that poignancy enforces the jokes for me. But I can bang on about it at length later on if necessary. So, Jono, when we talked about you coming on, you said Time Slides was an episode that you thought about a lot, especially during the COVID pandemic, which we've kind of touched on a little bit. So I've got loads of questions, but I thought I'd throw it to you to begin this. Is there somewhere that you'd like to start with our discussion of Time Slides?
I'd like to start in that boy's boarding house, because I'd never... Right. It had never occurred to me, the thing you just said. Like, I don't know why that never occurred to me.
Super creepy.
I've thought about the photograph, the boundaries of the photograph, the physics of that so much over the last 30 years. Not once have I questioned how there's a photograph of some sleeping boys.
Yeah, honestly, that's a huge twist for me. I guess because I know these episodes so well from being a kid, I guess you just don't.
Yeah,
you know,
you stop seeing stuff. Yeah, honestly, it troubled me so much that I did try to think. Since we've gone there, I did try to think of a rational explanation for it, for all of it, actually. But let's just stick with the dorm room. For me, I think we see young Rimmer sleeping in boxing gloves. Even his teddy bear's got an army helmet on. So I think maybe he's set up a motion activated camera in case of bullying. That's my theory. I think that works.
You always forget, because whenever they show, like when they show the pub in this episode, and when they show the boarding house. The pub looks like it's in the 80s, the boarding house looks like it's in the 70s, when they you know, they've gone, well, 10 years ago, what did 10 years ago look? And they've forgotten that it's...
Yes, it's set quite far in the future, yes.
Yeah, so I guess motion-activated camera, I was instinctively going to be like, how did they... But yeah, you forget it is meant to be the future.
They're still using cassettes, they can't have motion-activated cameras.
Yeah, for sure. The moment when... I even felt it when you said it then, but I the bit of this episode I used to fixate on was... Rimmer finding out he's alive and dying again straight afterwards. I struggle with this in general of like over emoting with things. I've had it since I was a kid, and I would feel lightheaded at that bit because I couldn't stop thinking about how unbelievably cruel that was. Like that moment, I found it excruciating that had happened. And I would start to, it still happens to me as an adult sometimes, but like I'd start to feel lightheaded, like I might faint, because I just couldn't believe he's got everything he wanted and it went away, you know, 5 minutes later.
But that means you've got some sympathy for him at that point.
I have sympathy for him all the way through the show. I'm on his side, even when he's at his absolute worst.
It is possibly the worst thing that happens to him, isn't it? Like, it is arguably worse than the Lisa Yates memory, because at least he only has to live with that for a few days. Now he's, as you say, he's had a moment of living again, which is all he really wants, and then...
He did die.
But dying the second time is so much worse. Everybody's dead, but the fact that he comes back to life and then is dead straight away is cruel beyond measure. And I think at the time I wasn't really aware that a writer wrote that. And now I think I don't know that in a similar situation I'd be able to pull the trigger on that plot point. I think I'd just be like, that is, it's so unspeakably horrendous what happens to him.
His little speech that sets it all up, why does nothing ever go right for me? Every time I get so much as a snifter of a break, a glimpse of a shadow of happiness, something inexplicably cruel and horrible happens and it all blows up in my face, which obviously is a lovely bit of foreshadowing. I was going to ask, is that one of those examples of where you feel like it's a little bit overwritten, or do you just go with that? Because it is very nicely crafted, but it's written.
Yeah, yeah. But I think it's not written going forwards. It's only afterwards that you feel it. Things like that just feels poetic, and like where it leads feels like it's heavily ironic.
Well, while we're talking about how it's put together, can we take a minute to appreciate the plot and the elegance? It just races along. There's so many twists and turns. Loads of stuff happens. It's thematically rich. And yet somehow, like any good sitcom of the time, at least, I think we'd probably maybe want more from our sitcoms these days. But, you know, it ultimately just resets everything. It, you know, if you are receptive to the themes like I was this time around, you, the audience, might be changed, but the crew are exactly as they always are.
Yeah.
Brilliant race to the reset.
Yeah. It's a really aggressive reset.
Yeah, they are telling you. Yeah,
Holly literally says, you've put everything back the way it was. She's speaking to Doug Nail and Rob Grant at that point.
Yes. Like Thanks for the Memory, it fills in so much of their lives. I love hearing about their lives. I love like what their lives were before, anytime they're talking about that. Seeing Lister as a teenager, it's such a small change that sorts Lister's life out altogether and makes him the wealthiest person in the world. I like seeing that kind of thing on screen, because I feel like, yeah, that's basically justice. Like, that's what the world's like.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's a brilliant lesson, isn't it? When you watch it as a younger person, you don't realise that it's actually showing you something quite profound about life, that for all you have your you know, boundless optimism, and you live on nothing but hope and aspiration, and yet you will meet reality, and you will eventually start to appreciate that most of the best things that will happen to you are pure chance, and it's all about how you respond to them.
I remember even as a kid, though, looking at young Lister going, oh, he's naive.
Oh, yeah, oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah, I was half that teenager's age when I first saw this episode, probably, and even then I was like, oh, dude. He's quite close to Rick in Young Ones. That political poetry aspect but you get the feeling there's no basis or understanding of the situation to inform that poetry or that arrogance.
Well, what I quite like, that's there if you want it to be there, and you can discard it if not, but you know, you can either read Lister purely and simply, the young Lister in Spag and the Heads, as, you know, he's just a teenager being, you know, trying to be shady, as he would probably put it, and therefore he does the sort of silly things and says the silly things that we all do as teenagers. But the fact that we then see that wealthy Lister is a pillock, whereas unsuccessful Lister is a pretty cool guy, I quite like that. You know, that sense that maybe Red Dwarf is the best thing that ever happened to him, actually, in terms of his humanity.
It's an insane decision, again, but I find it very funny him calling him Mr. Rumour. Like, like, how could he possibly have misheard the name that badly? Could you escort Mr. Rumour? is it pronunciation or is it? But I do really like gravy and onion bap. That I find that really funny that he would do that. I also find the name Sabrina Mulholland Jones.
Yeah, it's great.
In the I feel like she's mentioned in the novels, and I hadn't seen it written down until that point. And I remember being surprised that it's a double J at the start. I was just like, there should surely be a vowel between those J. Otherwise it would be Jones, but it's Sabrina Mulholland Jones.
I'd backwards engineered that in my head. I thought it was Sabrina Mulhollinger Jones.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, I'd done the same.
So changed the spelling in the book, like, retrospectively to make it funny.
Yeah, maybe. I know I'd seen it in the episode first, and when I saw it written down, I remember laughing out loud at that as a name, Jones.
What's Ruby Wax's character called, though?
Blaze Falkenberger.
Because it starts to be like one of those Key and Peele draft sketches.
Yes.
There was a really, really, I can't remember who it is, an insanely famous actor was going to play that part.
Yes,
who was it?
I was just going to say, so there's some really interesting casting stuff we could talk about, actually, around all the characters we've just mentioned. So it was Graham Chapman.
It was
cast, and he died just before rehearsal started. I don't want to make too many assumptions. Ruby Wax obviously was a big deal at this point, but she's Ed By's wife as well, so I assume that was an easy, you know, easy phone call to make. But yes, it would have been Graham Chapman, which would have been very different, actually, goes without saying.
Yeah. They certainly rewrote the part for Ruby Wax, though, right? There's no way Graham Chapman was going to play a character called Blaze Falkenberger and do all the kind of shoulder-padded 80s sexy stuff, you know?
Yeah, and also delivers it like Ruby Wax would do on her own show as well. Like, it feels like it's written for her.
We mentioned the fish and chip emporium. I just want to give a shout out to Gilbert. That actor's line reading, I want to believe this was his choice rather than something that they'd spelt out in the script. But I just absolutely adore the fact that he chooses to deliver fish and chip emporium as fish and a chip emporium.
Yes.
As if he's never heard of such a thing before. It's awesome. But this guy's backstory, I think, is worth mentioning purely because it has some kind of deep parallels with the emotions that this episode stirs up for me now as an older man. The actor's name is Robert Addy. You might recognise him, you might not. He's in, he plays Mordred in Excalibur, John Borman's movie. Audiences of the time that Time Slides came out, there would have been a fair chance they'd have recognised him, because he'd played Guy of Gisborne in the TV series Robin of Sherwood, which had been a pretty big deal from 84 to 86. So he had a pretty bloody good career. And he actually, shortly after Time Slides, I don't think it's related, but he took a 5-year break from acting. Don't know why, but it looks like he just went travelling. Came back in the mid-90s, got right back into it, was doing pretty well. But he passed away in 2003 of lung cancer. He was just 43 years old. Oof. And you just think, wow, you know, make the most of your time, guys. This is really uncharacteristically sincere for this podcast, but this episode really stirs up a lot of stuff for me about what are you doing with your life. I'm doing a Red Dwarf podcast, all right.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com.
real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Craig Charles wrote 3 songs in the episode written by him, not just Armstrong.
Yes.
But...
I quite like the urgent darkroom photo printing theme. It's quite good, that, isn't it? It's a bit of rock stomp.
I think the money theme's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's up there with Tongue Tied, isn't it? It's one of another funk classic early Red Dwarf. I want to know what it means that Craig Charles wrote Om, because to what extent is that song even written? Does that? It would be awesome if they literally gave him free rein and went to come up with something, and he came up with the whole Om thing and everyone's just riffing on that.
Or it would be amazing
set.
If it is like, you know, like Captain Beefheart, where he would like, it sounds like garbage when you listen to it, but he did actually write it all out.
Mm.
And he was like, no, I want you to go, beep, beep, boop, 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 and all those notes are written out. Like, do that.
Yes.
It's like, wait, so that's not just playing any old note. The thing that resonates most with me about this episode is during COVID, there was a period of time where I sort of got what I'd always wanted. Everything had been postponed.
Mm.
So it was nowhere I needed to be, but I was financially okay for a bit. And I lived by myself in a place I really liked. And I had 4 months, basically, you know, until things opened up in the summer, where I was like, oh, I've got it. I've got as much time as I could possibly need to do whatever I want. And went totally mad within a month or two. 2 weeks in, if you'd said, listen, we're going to stop everybody dying, there's going to be no more pain, but lockdown is going to keep on going anyway forever, I'd go, yes, please. Perfect. Please. 2 weeks later, I would have cried at the thought of it lasting another day. I spent a lot of time like thinking about what have I done that's meant that I'm alone in this situation. There should surely be, is there other ways I could have behaved whereby I wouldn't be alone right now? And that brought me back to thinking about time slides. Is there any, and I was walking past obviously a wall of photographs from times where I was like, if I could go into that photo at that time, I could say this differently, and always small things, or this, and then perhaps X would be there with me. Or that person who I've sort of fallen out of contact with. Well, if I'd gone to their birthday on this day, perhaps they would have been like, they didn't live too far away. We could have gone for a walk every day. During lockdown, I felt like people who lived alone, I think, were in the time slide situation suddenly. Any sci-fi that explains what's happening, I'm not into.
Mm.
Anytime somebody explains how a piece of technology works, I just think, well, I know that sentence isn't true, because otherwise it would exist. So tell me the sentence. Don't let's not go into it, because you can only say something that's wrong. So just don't. And so what this episode is a thought experiment, and the buy-in is the development liquid is that's mutated, and now we can go in the past. And I'm just totally fine with that as an audience.
Yeah.
Of like, if I have to swallow that to watch this thought experiment play out, then fine. The episode wouldn't be better if there were 10 minutes going into how it's happened.
Did you spot what Crichton's actually doing? Thematically, for the rest of the episode, I think it's kind of sound. He is developing photos of his own birthday party from a couple of years ago, back when his original crew...
Yeah, the Nova 5, yeah.
...were still alive, right? They cameo, the three of them, in their orange jumpsuits. Last time we saw them, they were on skeletons.
I'm going to write myself annoyed emails for even pointing this out, but he should look like the David Ross Crichton... continuity terms. Shoot me.
Oh, John.
Another thing that makes me really emotional in this episode is, you know, when Big Brother came out, they would show you a 24-hour feed. The start of this episode where they're playing the games makes me think, I would have done anything for a show of just the 24 hours. I'm interested in the days where nothing happens in Red Dwarf.
It feels like that should undermine the sci-fi-ness of Red Dwarf, but actually it just speaks to how awesome the characters are. Yeah. Those four in a room, brilliant.
Yeah. A lot of what I like about Red Dwarf is the restriction of the budgets, where there'll be an extraordinary sci-fi premise, and what it amounts to in practice is them going and sitting in a room. Like, there's and often describing the amazing stuff that's going on outside of the room. I mean, the ultimate example is in Back to Reality, where they go to the what we think is the real world going forwards, and all we see them do is sit in that room and then walk into a car park. We then cut to the Starbug sequence, where there's the chase, and they brilliantly evade it by showing the other side of the showing them having the hallucination instead of the actual thing they're hallucinating. But like, the only thing we see of that world is them standing in a car park. But I feel like I've gone on a huge journey into that alternate reality. But there was just four guys stood in a car park. I think it's Rimmerworld, where, like, that would be such an exciting thing to see. They see that throne room, and then they're basically in a jail cell. And then they're talking about it from there. Also, the terraform, that they just go to that dungeon straight away. Yeah. And don't really see any of the rest of it. There's a couple of establishing shots, but you don't get the sense that anybody was actually there. I love that most of these stories are, they go and sit in a room and chat.
Yeah.
But you can imagine so much around it. It feels like they're in these rich settings.
That's so true. I can't believe I've seen these hundreds of times. I've never thought that before, but you're right. They feel full in scope.
Yeah, you feel. When I think back on them, I think, oh, that's where they went to that amazing planet where there was millions of, and there was this, like, and they just sat in a room and had a chat over and over again. And it's always compelling.
Did you spot that Rich Lister is wearing a Wilma Flintstone T-shirt?
Oh, nice.
Oh, whoa! I didn't realise that.
That's great.
I sometimes find myself thinking of the line, but I'd be thinking of Wilma.
Yes.
What episode's that? It's in the first three.
It's the start of Backwards.
It is the start of Backwards, that's right, yeah.
Because where we see that they've moved to the officer's quarters.
So, I wanted to get your take on the "you call this happiness" speech that Rimmer does to Lister.
"It's you, isn't it?" is a beautiful punchline. It's about as good as you're going to get.
So good. It's a Rimmer classic as well. Chris Barry has been given lots of jokes, which are essentially long speeches which undermine themselves just at the last minute. What he's amazing at is not telegraphing.
Exactly. Yeah, the performance of it is outstanding, isn't it? Yeah.
You can see him realise what the end of his speech is going to be maybe a millisecond before he has it. You know,
yeah.
"It's you." And in his defence, he sort of admits it as soon as he realises it himself. Yeah. Like, "It's you. Who's the richer man?" "Yeah, it's you."
And I love that, like, through, admittedly it's through the prism of Rimmer, so maybe we're not meant to take this as a universal statement, but I like the fact that this resolves on a bit of a truth that we all would like to believe, that money doesn't buy happiness, but it clearly does to some extent. It doesn't make you happy forever, but you'd be happier with it than without it, right? And I quite like the fact that they just let that lie there.
You get the impression that Rimmer and Lister's lives without interference were tough, and like, they've taken these jobs that are not great and they're not really happy doing, and they wanted to do it, but they just had to. I find it comforting watching any story where somebody gets extraordinarily lucky and things work out. I feel like that's a good story for kids to see. I think it's healthy.
But then there's that bittersweet element here where Rich Lister really isn't a nice guy particularly. He thinks he is, but he's a bit of a prat.
He's just, he's a prat. He just, like, what we might at the least say is he's a prat like his teenage version.
Yes.
Which I suppose amounts to saying he would only grow by not having money. In the world where he does have money, he remains a prat.
Yeah.
Also, he was a prat in 1989. I think that's different to a prat now.
True.
It's like a slightly different culture of, like, it's cool to have money. I don't think he would have been written the same now, probably.
For some reason, I'm slightly obsessed since watching this week with the idea of someone should do a stupid YouTube thing where they cut in the end of the original Planet of the Apes movie with Charlton Heston going, "You did it, you finally did it," and then we cut away instead of the Statue of Liberty, it's just that statue of Lister pissing into a fountain. I was going to mention the tension sheet. It's such a simple, stupid idea, but I find it compelling that could make you a millionaire.
I remember having the thought as a kid, maybe I could sell red popping paper. I was like, it's one of those things where you think, well, I think they have invented something there that probably would sell. You could sell them for maybe, yeah, maybe even a couple of quid.
I reckon it's where the script started. I reckon they started with Tension Sheet and went, oh, imagine if we thought of that.
Yeah.
I do love the way they introduce it, like it's a throwaway gag and then it becomes pivotal to how the entire plot revolves.
Yeah.
Would it start with that, or would it start with them going, we've got to invent something that would be really popular but doesn't require being smart?
But how, as a writer, how would you go about solving that riddle, like answering that question? That's right. Impossible, isn't it?
That's almost impossible.
Every writer's room I've ever been in has at some point involved the following situation. Somebody's like, right, we've nearly finished, but to make this bit work, we need a line. It needs to be a word that is also a number. The number has to start with X. I know no numbers do start with X, but stay with me. And it has to also be the name of that guy's cousin. And that can't not be Arthur. That has to be Arthur, but it has to start with X. And that, like, where you've got into a situation where you're like, we've got to come up with an impossible thing. And you spend half the day, or it'll be like, oh, we need them to sing a song that somehow summarizes this and convinces them to do this. And it's like 10 different masters it's got to serve, this line. In my, I've been doing this as my 9-to-5 job for 13 years now. I am telling you now, and I've never, ever, ever seen anyone solve such a thing. Either somebody comes in the next morning and they had an idea that does it, or the next morning somebody comes in and goes, it is impossible, isn't it? And you go, oh yeah, let's just change the whole episode. For that reason, I think I actually am coming around to, I think I agree with you, Fergus, that I think they must have had the idea first, because they wouldn't have got to it otherwise. Yeah.
No, it's almost impossible.
But it is undeniably a brilliant solution they land on. So that all we're doing, like, the more you talk about it, the more you realise, yeah, that is an impossible thing they've done. So Grant and Naylor must be genuine, like geniuses, to come up with that. That's incredible.
Or really dumb to not sell it.
I just wanted to mention Kat's outfits in this episode, just really quickly. His golfing outfit is impeccable. The plus fours, the bow tie, the bobbled hat. But the second costume he wears is barely noticeable because of all the exciting things that are going on. But he's pretty much dressed up as a priest out of Resident Evil 8, like a dark clergyman or something. He's wearing a gold suit with black fur epaulettes and a tall bishop's hat. It's nuts. I think a lot of people missed it, but I was absolutely obsessed with it.
I also really respect you for saying Resident Evil 8 rather than Resident Evil Village.
One question we haven't asked you, Jono, have you got a favourite moment, favourite bit in Time Slides?
The moment after Rimmer explodes and Lister and the others turn to check what the noise was, and they're like, oh, I don't know. And then they move on. I think the indifference that other people can have towards the most important and significant things in our lives. Sometimes if you're like walking down the street on an extraordinarily sad day, like after I had it once after a funeral, and somebody drives past and they're playing really happy music from the car, and simultaneously you can have a really happy day and then you'll see a hearse go past or something like that. Yes. It's just a reminder that, like, everybody's got their own stories. They're not at the same point in the narrative as you.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's just something about that moment where they turn and it's nothing to them. It's a weird noise. They didn't notice that he didn't have the H on his head. They didn't, and now he has had the most horrendous thing that's ever happened to him happen, and they are just getting on with that day.
Wonderfully bleak.
just because I suddenly remembered I'd done this, I'm not going to read my rankings of episodes, but I will, if you'll permit me, because I can't think of another forum I'll ever be allowed to read such a thing. I have ranked the seasons.
Go for it.
That's exactly what we need, actually. It's quite a climax to the episode as well.
I'll go from bottom to top. 13, Back to Earth. 12, 11, 11, 12, 10, 10.
Fair enough.
9, Promised Land.
Okay, so that's all the Dave stuff taken care of.
Oh, this does not fill me with hope.
But 8, 7, 7, okay. 8.
Ah, okay, 8's just slightly better for seven than 7 for you. Nice.
So, well, because you get more, you get those Lister and Rimmer chats. So now we're on to, we knew what the top 6 would be. It's going to be the original 6. Number 6 is the 4th season.
Okay.
Ooh.
Interesting.
Number 5, the 6th season. Number 4, the 1st season.
Wow, okay.
3, the 3rd season.
Yes, okay.
Number 2, the 5th season. And number 1, the 2nd season.
Incredible. Wow. What a lineup. There were moments there where you reminded me of an episode of Lost. Some random numbers, yes. Strings of numbers, meaningless.
Well, 12 was 11, 11 was 12, and also 7 was 8 and 8 was 7.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for allowing me to read that out loud. I didn't think I'd ever get an opportunity to say that to a human.
I'm so happy we have that recorded. Yeah. And actually, do you know what? This could be a new format point, listener. If you want to rank the 13 episodes like Jono, we can compare and contrast the listings. Email us at betterthanlifepod@gmail.com.
Or if you want to tell me I'm an idiot, if you want to tell me I'm an idiot for that, and I'm and all the ways I'm stupid, I'm on This Is Jono on Instagram and Sheeps of Comedy on Twitter. If you want to tell me I'm a stupid idiot,
very nice.
Or the opposite, I come and find you to get more of your hot takes.
I'm okay for self-confidence. Don't just tell me if I'm an idiot.
It's been awesome.
Thank you so much for giving us so much of your time.
This has been an honest-to-God treat. I really, really, really enjoyed it, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure.
That's fantastic.
We love indulging you.
We do. Yes. Jono.
That was great. It's nice having writers on, isn't it? Because they really do, they are eloquent. Yeah. They elocute very nicely.
Yeah, he was elocuting all over the place. I love getting someone who is the triple threat of amazingly funny performer, genius writer, and deep down in the dirt, proper listing, ranking, obsessing fan. It's awesome.
Yes. Yes, what a treat. He really kept that under the radar till right at the end of the podcast. Listener, he surprised us with that list of series ratings, and it was really interesting to hear. But there were a couple of things that we didn't get to. I suppose little bits and pieces and specifics that we didn't get to talking about the episode that I'd love to chat through with you, if that's all right.
Well, I think we can do that.
I do feel that this is the episode where the Crichton we get in the future of the series, where he's basically an exposition machine.
Right.
This is the first time you really see that, you really see Crichton settling into that role. He has the scene at the beginning where he does kind of crazy kind of chicken head bug eyes at the photos.
Clearly,
was there a worry about his makeup, do you think? Do you think Ed Bye said, listen, Bob, you're really going to have to sell this. You're seeing something shocking off screen, but the makeup might be getting in the way. So give us a lot of head movement for that moment.
I think they were just too excited to discover that Robert Llewellyn can take his own eye out and polish it. They just were like, how can we get that in? That's amazing.
Just slap in the back of the head. It was very quick. I do like the editing in that moment. It's not overdone. It's not. His eyes are in his hands. He cleans them, put them back in. It's fine. It's fine.
You're right, though, about Crichton. And I think it's a mark of how much I enjoyed this episode that I didn't notice, because I absolutely love Crichton.
He makes the discovery. He literally he exposes the catalyst, the exposition. Holly helps him along a little bit with the fluid's mutated, which is that one bit of sci-fi lamp shading, but that's pretty much it.
Poor old Crichton. Well, he'll get more to do.
Yeah. Whereas Kat doesn't have much to do either in this episode, but is at least resplendent in his +4s and later black bishopric hat.
Yes. Yeah, he gets some extraordinary couture in this episode.
I like the attention to detail that implies. The fact that he's wearing a full-on golfing outfit while playing table golf. I love the idea that he's dressing up for these things. I want to know what he's dressed up as or how he's dressed for the other kind of corridor sports that they've invented. But talking of attention to detail, do you spot that there's a little mini fan on the table golf course to emulate wind?
No, I didn't see that. That's great.
They've been thinking, talk about overthinking corner. I don't think we're the ones overthinking anything. Lister and the cat have put together a tabletop game and they've gone, but in a real game of golf, there's wind, isn't there? Wind would affect the ball, like either of them would know. We've already seen Cat throwing his clubs rather than hitting the ball in Better Than Life. So how they're professionals. Maybe they came back from Better Than Life going, we should really explore that golf thing. Well, we'll need wind. We'll need to emulate wind. So, that's good sci-fi stuff, though, isn't it?
It is good.
Sci-fi is well made when fans can watch and see, oh, look at that little thing they've thought of. Look at that little thing
the
they've
detail.
Thought of. The missing H at the end. It's so easy not to notice.
It's true. And speaking of guest actors making the most of their moment, I think we didn't talk at all about the person who possibly shines the most in this episode, because it's not an easy thing. People assume that when the cameras are on you, it'd be really easy to just be yourself. Adolf Hitler absolutely nails it.
It's not easy playing yourself, and you know, you can imagine the producers approaching you, kind of playing an asshole version of yourself. Oh God.
Oh, you took that ball and ran with it.
I did. I yes-handed you, and now I'm not sure I should have. It's a bold thing to start an episode with Adolf Hitler as himself. I can imagine that getting some really nice laughs off people watching this for the first time. Yeah. We know a couple of people who are watching along with this podcast, which is really cool. And I can imagine them watching the start of this episode and finding that just ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I don't know if it's faded over time, but definitely all the way into the 80s, it was kind of the done thing to mock Hitler, wasn't it? You know, British audiences absolutely love mocking Hitler.
Yeah.
And he gets thoroughly mocked here. The handcuffs, the banana and crisp sandwich, the to-do list, including invade Czechoslovakia, you know.
It feels like that list is the list that they came up with to justify having him in the first place. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
we've got to make sure that the audience understands how we feel about Adolf Hitler.
Yes, yes.
Have you ever had a banana and crisp sandwich?
No, I haven't, actually. I
wonder what flavour crisp.
That's probably key, isn't it?
Listener, are we talking ready salted? Or are you talking like an extreme tang, like salt and vinegar, to offset the kind of earthy sweetness of the banana?
Well, also then, how ripe is the banana? It's all very easy writing banana and crisp sandwich in a script, but...
We could assign it to the idea that whoever was making Adolf Hitler's lunches hated him and just made him a rubbish sandwich.
And rightly so, because we do hate Hitler.
Let's just reiterate that, just in case.
In case we haven't made that clear enough.
I don't think we should be talking about him anymore. Except for the fact that there is a magazine in the future called Fascist Dictator Monthly, and Rimmer subscribes.
I think this is quite prescient. I mean, it's just a throwaway gag, isn't it, really? But certainly the way the world is going, it's easier to believe now that there would be a Fascist Dictator Monthly magazine in the future.
That's true.
To which ostensibly normal people might even subscribe than it might have been in 1989, I would guess.
Yeah. I wonder how much they paid attention to futurology, or how much they worried about that. Do you know what I mean? Were they like, what cinematic flop are they going to be talking about in the future?
Right,
200
yes.
years from now, and by extension, 3 million years.
Yeah.
Ishtar. Ishtar's the one they landed on. I haven't heard anyone mention Ishtar for about 20 years.
No. Heaven's Gate was the go-to for quite a while, wasn't it?
It
but
was.
Again, nobody talks about that anymore. Is it Batman versus Superman? I don't know.
I mean, people could cite like some of the recent Marvel movies as being flops. Or that last Indiana Jones movie, The Dial of Destiny, apparently made back half the money they spent.
Did it? Oh.
Yeah.
That's a shame. Indiana Jones is one of my favourites.
You know what? We've talked about the Adolf Hitler cameo. We haven't talked about... There's comedy royalty in this episode. Mark Steele... Well, he'd probably hate to be called royalty, actually. Excuse me.
He would, yes.
But,
yes.
But Mark Steele has a non-speaking role as the male skier.
As the male
in
skier.
In the skiing photograph that Lister accidentally inherited.
So it was cast as a speaking role.
Oh, no. Okay.
So that's why they've actually got someone in with a bit of profile, a bit of name. I mean, I wouldn't have said he was famous at the time, but, you know. Basically, what happened is there was going to be a whole dialogue bit when Lister goes into the photograph where the skiers would be talking about how they got Lister's birthday, but they would be like, you know, recognise him and going, it was your birthday pics or something. And Craig Charles, either in rehearsals or certainly post being sent the script but pre-shoot, pointed out that that was a continuity error because the skiers wouldn't have had the birthday photos yet because they are in the photo that was sent to Lister by mistake. So they just cut all of the dialogue. But Mark Steele was still paid as a proper actor, not an extra.
Oof. That's still rough, though. I mean, yeah, the money, I'm sure that's nice, but an opportunity to have a key speaking role in a funny scene on a BBC Two primetime sitcom.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Series 3. Oh, I'm going to be in Red Dwarf. I'm going to be in Red Dwarf. When's your Red Dwarf coming out?
Oh, God.
Oh, not sure.
Tie on top of that, the fact he's in ski wear in a snowy landscape and you can't necessarily see him that
yes,
well.
You can't tell
and
it's him
And it was filmed in the
all.
80s, so frankly, unless you're watching a nice remaster of the episode... Oh, poor Mark Steele.
It's true.
And to be fair, poor Louisa Ruthven, who played Ski Woman.
Is that what they're credited as?
Ski Man and Ski Woman. Yeah.
Lovely. Should have given himself a name like Count Ludo.
I think that's the side. If you're in a sci-fi show and your character doesn't have a name in the script, just go straight to the director or the writer and say,
yeah,
can I call this character something? They will say, writers, they'll love that question. Yes, please. Let's come up with an awesome sci-fi name for you. Count Ludo. Brilliant. I mean, maybe that's how they named the cats in the script for ease. Maybe there's one called Lord Scrabble, one called Duchess Snakes and Ladders.
There's two bits that I want to talk about. The first bit is I just want to honour Craig Charles's, again, it's just an immaculately great line reading. The Charles Keeler gag. Did you go to school with anyone famous? Charles Keeler, he was pretty famous.
Yeah.
And the way he delivers at his wife.
Yeah.
It's just peerless,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it is.
It's just so, he nails it.
It's like the no. Would you like to join me for a cocktail? No.
It is, yes.
It's like arsehole,
yeah,
in the Crichton episode. He's really good. Maybe it's because he's so sincere. He believes all these things he's saying and he does so much heavy lifting. In this episode, I hate my life. At least when you're in prison, you can look forward to getting out. That whole, he's carrying the weight of that on his shoulders. And so maybe it is that when you remove all of that and you just have to get him to say something simple and punchy and just, I wonder if they had a shorthand where Ed Bye would just say to him, look, this is one of those lines.
Mm.
Just give it nothing. The less you give this, the funnier it'll be.
Mm.
You tore up and ate a photograph of his wife. No, arsehole.
Yeah.
And yeah, I believe this might be the fourth one of those, essentially.
See, that's made me realise, talking about what it is, why he does it so well, that sincerity. His closest peer as an actor probably then, and this is something I never thought I'd say, is Mark Wahlberg. That's Mark Wahlberg's special skill as well, is that he's just utterly sincere about anything you ask him to do. That's why he's so funny.
Mm.
He doesn't have to think about being funny. He just has to play the lines straight in a funny script.
Yeah.
We can't possibly leave the listener without answering the most important question that this episode begs. Under what circumstances would you need a condom that calls you back?
That feels to me like a Rob Grant joke.
Mm.
Insofar as Rob Grant was obsessed at points with bureaucracy and the ridiculousness, the Sisyphean effort of governmental bureaucracy, and following on from that, incompetence, and following on from that, crap, just stupid products, things you don't need, like a toaster that will talk you insane, for example.
Yeah.
That feels like the same kind of thing.
Yes.
I had questions. If we're talking about slightly naughty stuff, and you mentioned it in the episode, Rimmer's boxing gloves.
Mm.
Why do you think Rimmer's wearing boxing gloves?
So I think it is an anti-bully protection device of some description. I think that he feels that if he's seen to be sleeping in boxing gloves, the bullies may think twice about messing with him. That's also my rationale for the photograph. I think it's all a self-preservation mechanism.
That makes sense in terms of a dumb child thinking that, but that's a lot of justification, isn't it? Because boxing gloves are softer than a fist, so like to actually...
Yes. Indeed, yeah.
It would be about the message he's sending. And he is a bonehead, so it does make sense that he would choose to do something that obviously wouldn't work.
Yeah.
I ask because very clear memory of watching this particular episode with my dad and him laughing and laughing at the boxing gloves and me saying, why is that so funny? And my dad explained to me that tying boxing gloves onto teenage boys when they slept was a known method of masturbation prevention.
Really? Well, that'll be what it is then, because I'm sure
Rob
and Doug would be of a generation that would know that.
It does. It feels also like it does get a laugh of recognition rather than kind of sympathetic logic. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
When you see the boxing gloves, the audience does seem to be going, ah, boxing gloves.
Oh, but this,
yeah,
this
no,
opens so, up a whole... Because my whole rationale of making the photograph of sleeping boys in the dorm room not disturbing was that was part of Rimmer having an elaborate series of self-preservation mechanisms. But if the boxing gloves are to prevent him from doing naughty things in the night, then what the Jim will fix it is going on with that camera.
Do you know what? Let's forget onanism. Let's go back to your explanation that Rimmer, when he was young, was some sort of Kevin McAllister. Like, he set up traps.
Unsuccessful one.
In a shared dormitory as well. Poor Rimmer. However you look at it, what a life. And it was interesting that Jono comes out, not in favour of Rimmer, but sympathetic towards Rimmer.
Mm.
And this is, I guess, an episode to do that in.
Yeah.
Because it feels like he comes very close to winning. And actually, this episode is proof of something that I've been resistant to, but which has been said over and over again by various guests, which is that Rimmer ain't bright.
Mm, yeah.
That he doesn't even, when he's trying to tell himself, his younger self, about the tension sheet and how it's going to make him rich, doesn't even think to make sure yes. that the guy that originally became
not
a billionaire
listening.
Of it is right there. He's right there, Rimmer.
It's so good. It's so good because it does kind of imply that actually in the rightness of all timelines under the eyes of God, that actually it was Rimmer that gave Thicky Holden the idea all along.
Mm, yeah.
In the plot Ouroboros eating its own tail.
Yes. Do you know what? I think that's been rumbling somewhere in my unconscious, but you saying that just now makes me think, yeah, of course, it is a circle.
It's the true sci-fi explanation, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's really nice. I like that. Well, it does foreshadow quite a similarly structured and bigger thing that's going to happen later on in the series.
Mm.
Series 7 and 10 kind of contend with this idea.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't remember. I've not seen Series 10, and I don't remember what that is from Series 7.
I think it's 7.
But I can't wait to find out.
Well, there's literally an episode called Ouroboros.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Which will be the answer. But for now, you'll just have to suffice with listening back to these awesome episodes we've done, and looking forward to next week's episode, which is an absolute banger. Series 3, Episode 6, The Last Day with Dulce Sloan.
What a series finale.
Oh, listener, be there for crying out loud.
It is your duty. Your duty as a complete and utter Red Dwarf fan.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.